You're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, and we are your true community radio station. And there's another great edition of the Surreal News coming up in a minute. Don't touch that dial. Your weapon of mass instruction coming up. For that. And thank you for joining us on another edition of the Surreal News here on WSLR. I'm Steve Norris, and my excellent co-host is Lou Larini. He's going to tell us who's on our show this morning. We got a packed show again.
Yes, we do, Steve, and it's going to be very interesting. First, we're going to have Tim Carr from Free Press on, updating us on perhaps some good news about net neutrality, that we may be
able to still have net neutrality,
which, you know, for all folks out there, it means a lot to all of us, any of us that use the internet, for sure.
Including this radio station.
That's right. And later on, we're going to have Mark Elliott, the executive director of Floridians for an Alternative to the Death Penalty, talking about ways to abolish the death penalty in Florida, the organization whose motto is execute justice, not people.
So a lot of you have a strong opinion about death penalty, and we're going to be looking at that in some detail about some of the botched executions, why we're doing it in the first place, with one of the experts who has a coalition of various organizations about
Absolutely,
it. So we're going to look at this in a big way. All right, we have some surreal news to report.
Of course. Republican mega donor Sheldon Adelson, I know we hear a lot about the Koch brothers, raked in $3.8 million in casino profits this last year. Casino revenue increased last year to a record $14.6 billion for the billionaire who spent nearly $100 million in 2012 trying to help a Republican into the White House. Casinos owned by Republican donors Adelson made profits of $3.8 million last year as revenue increased, leaving Adelson, quote-unquote, extremely pleased. Adelson, who is, in fact, the world's 17th richest man, according to Forbes, has an estimated fortune of $29 billion, collected total pay of $14 million in 2013. And Adelson did, in fact, spend $93 million trying to help a Republican into the White House and has already started donations towards Republicans in 2016. And yes, he did.
We know him here in Florida, too.
Yes, we do. He donated a few bucks to the anti-medical marijuana groups. God knows why he even cares about that. But, you know,
enough to defeat that.
He is in Vegas. So, and what about the Koch brothers, Steve? I mean, they've been in the news, too, haven't they?
Yes, and it's estimated that the Koch brothers and their various groups will spend almost $1 billion on the elections in 2016. This year, about $889 million or so planned. They have 17 organizations funded by industries, the Koch industries. The network raised $407 million for the 2012 campaign. The Republican Party spent about $675 million, just to put those in perspective. We're going to keep a look on that. There's more about that, but I want to move on to some other things as well here. And this story that's in the news has to do with our guest about death penalty, and that's in Texas. So yesterday we had Robert Lade, a 57-year-old intellectually disabled inmate convicted of murder, was executed by lethal injection. He was pronounced dead 27 minutes after the drug was administered. And he said he was really, really sorry. Now, the Associated Press said that the drug stings my arms, man. And he was taking deep breaths and then snoring. The Supreme Court did not intervene. The last-minute appeal here. Well, there's a lot of issues here. Should we be executing intellectually disabled inmates? And we're going to be talking about that with our most excellent guest coming up at about 35 minutes past the hour, so don't touch that dial. All right. You love your cat stories.
That's right.
Your Nine Lives cat stories? Is this Nine Lives cat stories?
This is a serious Nine Lives cat story. This is about a cat who returned from the dead up in Tampa. A cat in Tampa was on the mend after clawing his way back from the dead, surfacing 5 days after he was hit by a car and buried for dead, according to the Humane Society of Tampa Bay. Bart, the cat, is recovering from a broken jaw and facial injury, said the agency on Wednesday, the day after he underwent surgery. One of his eyes was wounded so badly it had to be removed. Humane Society is calling Bart a miracle cat, while the ordeal earned him the nickname Zombie Cat on social media. Of course, everything's a zombie
there.
You know, Bart's seemingly lifeless body was buried after he was hit by a car earlier this month, local media said. 5 days later, he showed up alive in a neighbor's yard. He had dug himself out of the grave slowly and made his way back home, albeit weak and dehydrated and in need of medical attention. Apparently, what had happened was, you know, he did get hit, you know, and his distraught owner, handed the cat to his neighbor because he just couldn't bear to bury him himself, you know, and he thought, sure, Bart was a goner, and the neighbor fortunately buried him in a shallow enough grave that, the brave boy was able to come back.
You know, they said, but the cat came back. They thought he was a goner, but the cat came back.
That's right. That is
very nice. All right, there you go. I know I can't sing bands, but all right. Let's do a little bit of torture here, and that's the torture report, and a couple of stories here coming out about that. The first of all is that the ACLU doesn't want the torture report to be buried and doesn't want the White House to hide the torture report. So this year, the ACLU filed an emergency motion to press the government to release the full CIA torture report, which is yet to be published. So last year, the Intelligence Committee produced a report describing all this detainee abuse, et cetera, and they sent the full classified version to the executive branch, to the White House. And now the new Republican chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee wants the torture report back. Hey, give it back to me, okay? Because they feel it will be suspect to public release because the White House is not having the same rules as the Intelligence Committee. So the ACLU said that returning the full report to the committee, which isn't subject to the full Freedom of Information Act, would prevent the court from ruling whether it should be released. Okay, so there's legal implications here about
sure.
Who has the report and who's a separate article here is that the CIA report found the value of the brutal interrogation and report was inflated. So that the report said that when people claimed that torture was valuable, that was false. That's in the report. They don't want that out, and that's
right.
What's going on here. So there's a lot of detail about the report and how it debunked many of the statements about how torture was thought to be valuable. Not going to get into that here because that would probably take up most of our show today.
But we're
going to keep an eye on torture-type things.
Well, you know, Steve, just one last comment. I don't know why they are fighting so hard to, redact this because I think that cat's out of the bag. Everybody pretty much knows, you know, and it's just the details right now.
I think what's interesting is we still have the old Bush guys, torture guys, who are still claiming that it did good and still claiming we should keep doing it and still claiming it was never against the law because some lawyer said it was okay.
Right.
And then on the other hand, we have the attorney general nominee testifying that it absolutely is illegal. It's absolutely torture, period. So we have these two completely different groups at completely different odds, and then we have the report in the middle showing the facts of what's really going on here. And then we want to bury that report. Okay, so we start to bury the report. Oh, the people that are claiming that it works, of course.
Right.
All right, so we see what's going on here.
Yeah. Obviously anti-American.
All right, don't touch that dial. In about 5 minutes, we're going to talk to Tim Carr about free press. But first, let's let go some mosquitoes.
That's right. Millions of genetically modified mosquitoes may be released in a Key West neighborhood. These genetically modified insects could be released in the Florida Keys if a UK biotech firm called OxyTech's proposal is approved. The firm has proposed the release of these GMO mosquitoes to help with current mosquito control efforts. So what exactly is all the fuss about? GMOs have received quite a bit of attention in recent years. BT crops, for example, can naturally repel certain insects, so require less insecticides. In this case, the mosquitoes possess what is called a dominant lethal genetic system. This means that essentially the mosquitoes die by themselves. The males carry inserted DNA, which causes the mosquitoes to depend on a dietary supplement that can only be found in a lab, but not in nature. And when these mutants breed with normal females, their offspring also need the supplement and then die. In recent years, mosquitoes have continued to spread diseases like dengue fever and chikungunya by biting and infecting people. Dengue causes muscle aches, et cetera, et cetera. But essentially, this fellow, Phil Lonobos from the Florida Medical Entomology Laboratory, said, "I think the science is fine. They definitely can kill mosquitoes. But the GMO issue is still something sticks as something of a thorny issue for the general public." There are people protesting this, and I think they're basically afraid that, you know, you start genetically modifying mosquitoes and, you know, you might make a mistake and, you know, you might make a mosquito that's like 6 feet tall.
It's interesting because I reported this on Stratosphere Sarasota with Nancy Norris on Wednesday morning, our science show where I co-host with her. This is an experiment. It's never been proven to work here. The OxyTech is out of Britain,
the
company, the UK, that's doing this. And the release of these mosquitoes is hopefully another way of controlling a disease that basically has no cure otherwise. So we don't have a vaccine for dengue fever. We don't have a cure, the antibiotics.
Sure.
And, you know, in this age now where we have more and more infections with antibiotic strains that are harder and harder to treat now,
right,
prevention and use of techniques like this may become more important and may be the only way of fighting some of these diseases.
You know, also, too, I mean, there is a downside to using insecticides, you know, to kill mosquitoes. I mean, I know, my dad, consummate gardener, when he moved to Florida, noted that there was a lack of bees to pollinate certain vegetables that he liked to grow and he realized that the bees, there weren't any bees because they spray so much here for mosquitoes that they killed everything else.
Yes.
You know, in certain areas, so.
All right. In terms of health stuff, we're going to talk about human health and Medicaid. So in Indiana, we have news here that on Tuesday, Indiana became the next Republican state to expand Medicaid. So that's Indiana Governor Mike Pence became the latest governor, Republican governor now, to accept an expansion of Medicaid to cover poor residents under the Affordable Care Act. The expansion starts February 1st. I'm not going to go into too much detail. About 350,000 people are going to be covered. The other governors in states like Arkansas, Ohio, Pennsylvania has also extracted concessions, including increasing the role of private health insurance plans for Medicare from Obama administration, which is trying to expand more Medicaid coverage for the poor. Indiana, 28 states, and the District of Columbia have expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. There are some details here. The Plan 2.0, which is what they're calling it, is beneficiaries below the poverty line, a first for Medicaid, includes other features which they call market-based. It differs because people with low incomes and disabilities are covered by a government program that pays for their medical care. Some other details here, we're going to keep an eye on this. But here in Florida, we know that, for example, it was estimated, I heard recently, that we're losing about $2 billion a year just on people showing up at care places like hospitals with problems that could have been prevented if they had Medicaid, and that if we had accepted the Medicaid here in Florida, which we're not, it estimated at least about $5 billion would have come in to the state. So we have a difference between losing two and gaining five, about $7 billion just per year. Just because of, well, only for political reasons. As far as we can tell, the only reason why the Republicans, the legislature, is not accepting this money which for about a million or so needy people here in Florida, men, women, and children, is just because, well, that's hard to describe, but maybe they're trying to prevent Obama from being reelected again or making him look bad. I'm at a loss for words here because it's just cruel things that they're doing to a million needy people, maybe for their own political benefit. I'm at a loss for words. If anybody knows, they're certainly welcome to tell me.
Their claim is it, and this is Rick Scott's claim, I don't trust the federal government. They promised us this money, and I don't believe they're going to come through, that they're going to promise this money supposedly, and then all of a sudden say, oh, no, we aren't going to give it to you, and it's going to be all on the poor taxpayers.
The problem with that is many states have just put into their legislation that can happen.
They just closed that possible
loophole. All right, do you want to do a story, or should I do a Media Matters Minute and then make a call?
Why don't you do a Media Matters Minute?
Let's do it. All right, here's our Media Matters Minute. Then we have Tim Carr from Free Press. Don't touch that dial. That's coming right up.
Matters Minute, I'm John Whitehouse. Conservatives pointed to an intense blizzard that hit the Northeast this week as evidence to disprove climate change. Eric Bolling, a co-host of Fox News' The Five, argued that less snow disproves global warming.
After all the catastrophic warnings, all the doomsday forecasts, the blizzard of 2015 hardly blew through the Big Apple after all. Many parts of the Northeast have been hit very hard, but the fact is meteorologists blew it. And so did the climate alarmists who are already blaming global warming before the storm even hit.
Radio host Rush Limbaugh claimed that more snow disproves global warming.
They're blaming global warming on massive winter storms. We got more snow, we got more winter storms happening in this country. The years are not getting warmer, and yet they continue to hit everybody with global warming.
In reality, climate science is firmly established. And according to Kevin Trenberth, a climate scientist, warmer ocean temperatures as a result of global warming played a key role in contributing to the severity of the blizzard. For more on this and other exciting stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
And we love those Media Matters Minutes, a nonprofit out of Washington, D.C., that reports on that media misinformation. You're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, your true community radio station. And this is News and Public Affairs, Surreal News, your weapon of mass instruction, with one of my favorite guests, Tim Carr, joining us one more time. We've also had Craig Aaron on before from Free Press. And let me just introduce you. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning to you. Thanks for having me on.
And Tim builds on Free Press's grassroots and policy network to provide universal access to open networks and protect free speech everywhere. He also served the executive director of MediaChannel.org. He was a VP of Global Vision, New Media. He has also worked as an editor, reporter, and photojournalist for AP, Time, New York Times, Australia, Consolidated Press, etc. He analyzes reports of media policy for the HuffPost. We see you there. You've got your blog, Media Citizen, which is great. You're also busy chauffeuring your two daughters to soccer matches in New Jersey. I see that on here, too. So thank you. You're Senior Director of Strategy. Well, there's been lots of stuff going on the Internet, and I have a few headlines here from your website. Just give us the latest. What's going on with net neutrality that we need to know about?
Well, net neutrality has reached a really important moment in its history. We've been working on this issue for almost 10 years now, and it's been a very long battle against a very heavily entrenched special interests that are funded by the phone and cable lobby. And we have, in 2014, started a process at the FCC whereby they were trying to rewrite new rules to protect the open Internet. And by all expectations, the agency is going to vote on that issue on February 26th. So a little less than a month away, we will have a vote, and we are very certain that the FCC is finally going to do the right thing. They're going to put in place rules under the Communications Act that would give this federal agency the authority to protect the public interest when it comes to our ability to connect and communicate with anyone else who is also on the World Wide Web. So we are on the cusp, after 10 years of fairly dedicated advocacy on this issue, of getting a massive win, getting the net neutrality protections that millions of Americans have asked for.
So the history here is very interesting. So mention Title II and how we got into this mess in the first place by having an FCC crippled, not able to control the Internet.
Yes, it was back during the Bush administration when the then chair of the Federal Communications Commission was a fellow by the name of Michael Powell. Michael Powell is Colin Powell's son. He comes out of telecommunications law, and he was a loyal to the Bush administration at the time. He put in place, or he took away the FCC's authority to protect consumers. He changed broadband access, which as it falls under a legal category in the Communications Act, from Title II, which is a common carriage classification, to Title I, which is a much less regulated category. Of course, the phone and cable lobby was very happy to have Michael Powell do this because it basically stripped the FCC of a lot of its ability to protect consumer rights when it comes to the Internet. Now, it's interesting because if you fast forward nearly 10 years from that time, we now have the same person, Michael Powell, as head of the most powerful phone and cable lobby in Washington. He is president of the National Cable and Telecommunications Association. So it's always interesting how the revolving door spins and people who were once in place to protect the public interest are now serving the interests of the corporate lobby that they were supposed to regulate.
Yeah, the door is spinning, and I think my head is spinning too. I mean, it's just so incredible here that he did that and essentially undermined the FCC's ability to even look at the FCC. So I remember that we had you on and Craig Aaron on and others from Free Press before during a time when basically the Internet for a while there, and correct me if I'm wrong, still there, completely unregulated. So there's no agency overlooking it at all. Am I correct in saying that?
Well, it has the FCC has a long history of having its claws pulled one by one, and it does, if you're talking about internet regulation, it's clearly the case as I just talked about. But also, the FCC is supposed to oversee the use of the public airwaves. They grant licenses to radio and television broadcasters, and their ability to protect the public interest in that realm of media has been stripped away as well. So it's taken a lot of lobbying. It's taken a lot of advocacy work by millions of people who are, you know, writing letters to Congress and calling the FCC to get our leadership in Washington to understand that kind of march away from consumer protections is ultimately very harmful, not just to consumers, but to our economic well-being. We have reached a point where deregulation has allowed for a lot of these kinds of monopolies that used to rule communications to reassemble themselves. We have Comcast, for example, which is the largest cable internet provider, wanting to merge with Time Warner Cable, which is the second largest cable internet provider. We've seen this reemergence of monopolies. And that's a result not of the free hand of the marketplace so much as it is of this kind of re-regulation of telecommunications law that has allowed them to become so powerful. And of course, the result is that Americans pay a lot of money for internet connections that are not that fast by comparison to what's available in other developed economies around the world.
And we have the oh, the industry may be being a little less than honest. So we haven't, you penned a blog yesterday, and the title of your blog, we're listening to Tim Carr from Free Press talking to us about net neutrality. The title of your blog yesterday was Record-Breaking Spectrum Auction Disapproves Industry's Title II Fears. All right, so what? Tell us what's that going on there.
Well, so one of the most valuable assets that the Federal Communications Commission oversees is the spectrum, the airwaves. And that traditionally that was about giving license to radio companies, broadcast companies, to use the airwaves for their purposes. But increasingly, as demand for smartphones has skyrocketed, spectrum has become a very valuable commodity for wireless carriers, companies like AT&T and Verizon, Sprint and T-Mobile that provide us with our smartphone connections. And so there was a very valuable segment of our public airwaves that has been up for auction over the last several months, and it's been a very furious bidding process. And you know, the agency had originally said that we'll probably get, you know, close to $10 billion to license use of the spectrum to these wireless carriers. Well, the auction just closed yesterday, and we raised $45 billion. Now, the storyline there is, one, wow, that's a lot of money. That's great. It's money that goes, most of it goes into the U.S. Treasury, which is nice. It's nice to be able to raise money for, you know, with for our government in that way. The other story is that this is a clear indication that the wireless carriers are very confident about the future of the wireless marketplace. They're willing to invest tens of billions of dollars in improving their infrastructure. Now, anybody who has a smartphone and an AT&T or Verizon connection is familiar with the frustration of not having enough bars to complete your calls or to use, you know, streaming apps for music and other things. So it's also good for consumers. But what it indicates also, and sorry, this is a bit of a long story, but it also indicates is that that confidence in investing in improving our wireless infrastructure has not been threatened in any way by the FCC's plans, and it's become very clear now that the FCC plans to implement Title II rules over both wireline and wireless carriers. So when we first started lobbying for net neutrality, when we first started advocating and, you know, on this issue, the industry's response was like, if you put those rules in place, we're going to stop investing in improving broadband infrastructure in the United States. There were all sorts of scare tactics that they were spreading around related to net neutrality protections. But as evidenced by the results of yesterday's auction, we see that, in fact, Title II rules don't inhibit them in any way from making those vital investments.
Yeah, and shining a light, I guess, is what this is all about. And we see the lies, the fakery, the lack of transparency on so many different levels. My personal experience of that is when I went to one of these open meetings. This was years ago, and we had some people from Clear Channel, and they all had the same piece of paper that with the same talking points, and they were talking about consolidation and how good that was, and how even though we had fewer media outlets, that was sort of the natural progression. We had many people at these meetings taking up time that so that the public didn't have enough time to speak at the meetings because they packed the room with people from the industry to try to push out the public. I was there in the room, one of those rooms, and I think you were too, the one in Massachusetts, is that correct?
Yes, I was there.
Yeah, so I mean, just spend 2 seconds and just tell us about your experience, and then I want to go on to Robert McDowell's testimony.
Sure. Well, the phone and cable lobby likes to dictate policy to Washington, D.C., and there are a lot of ways that they do that. They do spend tens of millions of dollars on campaign contributions. They spend hundreds of millions of dollars to hire lobbyists, but they also have these kind of insidious PR campaigns, which often involves hiring PR groups, these group, what are called AstroTurf groups, groups that will try to appear as if they're grassroots organizations but really receive all their funding from the phone and cable lobby. So what you saw and what we saw in Massachusetts on that day was Comcast actually spending money to fill seats at a public hearing. They actually hiring people off the streets, and they brought them to the public hearing 2 hours early. They filled up all of the seats in the front six rows with people who didn't care about an issue so that the real public, the public who really had something to say about the issue, couldn't get in. The fire marshal was there at the door. Soon after, Comcast brought in all of his people, all of their people. He barred the entry to people who wanted to come there, who actually had real stories to tell about the issue. So it was, this was an insidious effort by industry to prevent the public from having any say on an issue that's important to everyone in this nation.
And then just to take this one step further, last Wednesday before the state Senate Commerce Committee, we had Robert McDowell, getting some things wrong. So can you go through some of the things when net neutrality and the FCC policy, when Robert McDowell was talking about
sure.
his bad arguments?
So Robert McDowell is a former FCC commissioner. He's a Republican commissioner who served for several years.
Let me remind everybody, we're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida. It's half past the hour, 96.5 LPFM. And Tim Carr from Free Press, sorry to interrupt you.
No problem. So Robert McDowell, former FCC commissioner, and like Michael Powell before him, he left the agency and soon thereafter began working for the companies that he was once in office to regulate. He now is an attorney for Wiley & Ryan, which is a law firm in Washington, D.C. that counts AT&T and most of the large phone and cable companies as its clients. He was called before Congress to testify about net neutrality and Title II, and he trotted out a series of arguments that have been widely debunked. He said that net neutrality would hamper investment in building out broadband networks. So we've seen time and again over the last year that doesn't harm investment in any way. And we talked about that a little earlier in this segment. He's also said that there'll be taxes on internet users should we go to Title II. That's been largely disproven. Congress recently passed a tax moratorium that prevents these sorts of taxes on the internet from occurring. So he was, it's kind of sad in a way. You see someone who devoted much of his career to this issue, having to tell these kinds of industry lies simply because he is being paid to do so by the industry itself.
Ouch. All right, and let's just spend, and we just have about a couple minutes left here. Again, we're talking about net neutrality with Free Press, Tim Carr. Craig Aaron has also been on our show, too, in the past. If, let's say they had their ways, and you had described in the past, Free Press has told us how they would change the internet to something more like my cable, where I sort of have pay for certain channels. So can you describe, if we didn't regulate the Comcast and Verizon and these internet providers, what the internet would look like?
Sure. So, these internet service providers in the United States, companies like Comcast, AT&T and Verizon are making a good deal of money just selling us a connection to the internet, and that's always been the understanding. Is you find a provider, if you're lucky, you have a choice of more than one. You pay them a monthly fee, they get you online, and then they get out of the way. That is, you get to choose where you go, what you do online. Now they have increasingly seen that with the growth of the use of high-speed internet services, that people are watching television via their online connection, they're listening to music, they're sharing rich media, and they look at that and they say, well, we should actually do more than just give them a connection and get out of the way. We should give people a connection and then get in their way. We should tell them what websites they can use. They'll tell them what video streaming services they can use to watch movies. We should tell them what radio or music services they could use to listen to music. And then we'll strike deals with the music and movie industry to prioritize certain websites over others. The problem with that approach is that's not the way the internet was designed to work. The internet was designed to give power over your media experience to the individual users of the internet. They want to fundamentally re-engineer that fairly revolutionary idea so that they could earn more profits. Of course, the problem is that internet users like you and me don't want that to happen. So fortunately, millions of people have seized upon this issue, and they've called Congress and they contacted the FCC, and they said, we need to put back in place those rules that protect internet users from this sort of interference.
All right, I think we're going to leave it there. We've been listening to Tim Carr from Free Press. You have two sites. There's freepress.net, which has a lot of the information that we talked about here. There's also freepress.org, which, in my opinion, has sort of more international and some other issues as well having to do with media as well. Am I describing that correctly?
So freepress.org is another organization. That's not Free Press. Freepress is at freepress.net.
Freepress.net. Okay, very good. And thank you again, Tim Carr, for the work that you do.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
All right, we're going to go to a quick another Media Matters Minute here, and then stay tuned. We're going to talk about alternatives to the press to the death penalty.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm John Kerr. Several right-wing media figures and outlets, including Fox Business host Lou Dobbs and Breitbart.com, have attacked Loretta Lynch's nomination to be the next U.S. Attorney General. With Lynch's Senate confirmation taking place, we wanted to make sure you knew that some Fox figures have actually commended Lynch's record. Back in 2012, Bill O'Reilly praised Lynch.
She is a hero, and should be respected by all Americans for standing up to a gross injustice.
O'Reilly replayed that clip on a show in November. He and Fox host Megyn Kelly added,
Ms. Lynch is going to be the new Attorney General, and I'm heartened by that. I mean, this woman didn't have to do this. She did it because she didn't like the injustice. So now she'll get confirmed, right?
I have to say that I think this is the person who should be the most acceptable to the right wing or the Republicans in this country of anybody who President Obama was considering. She is a straight shooter.
O'Reilly and Kelly weren't the only ones to express support. In fact, News Corp chairman Rupert Murdoch noted that Lynch has a, quote, reputation for fairness and strict legality. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Well, we want to thank Media Matters. And Media Matters is a nonprofit out of Washington, D.C., and they do supply us with that media, with that misinformation out of Washington, D.C. that they look at. You're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, your true community radio station, where news and public affairs is surreal news, your weapon of mass instruction, and Lou Lorini is going to introduce our next guest.
Yeah, we are happy to welcome Mark Elliott today, who is the executive director of Floridians for an Alternative to the Death Penalty, which is a coalition of individuals and groups dedicated to abolishing the death penalty in Florida, whose motto is execute justice, not people. Thanks for coming, Mark. How you doing?
Good morning, Lou. Thanks for having this discussion.
Yeah, terrific. You know, first off, Mark, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and you know, for instance, like what inspired you to get involved in this cause?
Well, me personally, of course, I'm a Floridian. I live in Tampa. For me, it was a process. There's a saying that the more you know about the death penalty, the less you like it, and that was certainly true for me. And so it was a process. I started with trying to look at this objectively. You know, why are we killing people? Are these killings necessary? Because I've never liked unnecessary killing. And the more I looked into this, it just became overwhelming evidence and proof that these killings are absolutely unnecessary. In Florida, we have, in fact, it's the only alternative to executions is life in prison without the possibility of parole. And that's exactly what it means. People will go into prison, into a cage, and they will die there. And what that means is there's no reason to kill prisoners anymore who are considered to be a lifelong threat to society. We are safe from them. It's a choice to kill them. Someone said once, well, we don't like it, but it's a necessary evil. And if it's not necessary, what does that leave?
Yeah, you know, actually, I'd read a little story, you know, about you, and I guess in a newspaper, and I guess one of the first things that touched you off was a particularly ironic event. You had gone to protest, you know, the execution of you know, a Jewish gentleman in Florida in 2000, you know, which marked the first time they used lethal injection in Florida, and that was wasn't that true?
That's very true. And at that time, I went there not to protest, but just to find information. Information that was in the year 2000 was hard to come by.
Uh-huh.
And since then, I've tried to make information more available to Floridians and how to find it from other groups. But I went to a vigil across from the prison where vigils are still held today at the time of execution. And there was a rabbi with a congregation there, and he and I got to talking, and he said he was there to give last rites for the prisoner being executed. And this was the first lethal injection in Florida. And the rabbi and I were struck that they had picked a Jewish prisoner to kill when lethal injection had been developed by Dr. Carl Brandt, B-R-A-N-D-T, if people want to Google it. He was the personal physician to Adolf Hitler. And lethal injection was used to kill children with disabilities, adults with disabilities, Jews, and others considered to be undesirable. And we just were struck by the horrific irony of Florida choosing their first lethal injection victim to be a Jewish prisoner. And that's when I really decided I'd need to find out more about the death penalty, and take action if it looks like it's just wrong.
Yeah, you know what though? Since that ironic and horrendous event, you know, hasn't the execution business been booming under Rick Scott?
Well, yes, it has. And let's put this in context. You know, worldwide, the death penalty is going away. 2/3 of the nations of the world no longer use the death penalty in any way, shape, or form. The United Nations recently passed a resolution overwhelmingly for a moratorium on executions with the goal of abolishing it. The countries that are the top executing nations in the world currently are China, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and the United States. The United States has been in that top five for at least the last 10 years. North Korea is in there somewhere, too, but no one's not sure where because they don't give that information out. So that's the company we keep internationally with the death penalty and executions. And certainly those countries, China, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, North Korea, we don't think about them when we think about human rights and freedom and liberty and criminal justice. Now, nationally, the death penalty is going away as well. 18 states have either abolished it or just haven't used it since they were started. 6 states in the last 7 years have done away with the death penalty. And Florida has chosen a different direction. Alone, Florida is executing more prisoners than ever. New death sentences remain at highs we haven't seen in a long time. So we've taken a different course.
Yeah, isn't Rick Scott approaching you know, sort of a dubious record?
Rick Scott is
with the next execution, the one that's, I guess, scheduled for the middle of next month.
Right. Jerry Correll is scheduled to be executed by the people of the state of Florida under orders of Governor Rick Scott on February 26th. And Governor Scott has now tied the modern era record for the most executions by a governor, and he's only halfway through his term of office. So it's a real problem. And I personally am, you know, it's a mystery. This is all up to the governor. The governor controls if an execution is going to take place. The governor's the one that orders it. And Rick Scott, I'm so baffled by this. He claims to be pro-life, but yet he's killing more prisoners than any governor in modern times. And these are well-secured captive prisoners. They're not going anywhere. It's strictly a choice to kill them. It's not necessary to protect us and our families or anything like that. It's strictly a choice.
You know, and didn't, I guess this was around 2013, or was it last year, you know, the legislature, with the support of the governor, passed what was called the Timely Justice Act that kind of speeds the whole process up, right?
It was designed to do that. It changed somewhat in its final form. It left the governor as this, pretty much the sole gatekeeper, because the governor controls the clemency process entirely. And so no one can be executed until they've gone through their clemency process, and the governor controls that. So he doesn't have to sign any death warrants, doesn't have to order any executions. It's totally his decision. And for whatever reason, I personally think he's gotten some bad advice from a close advisor or two.
That's interesting, too. You know, as you alluded to earlier, you know, about sort of one of the practical issues around the death penalty, of course, there are, I believe, you know, moral and practical problems with the practice. One that I noted on a fact sheet you sent me, and I wish you would elaborate on it, is that adhering to the death penalty costs Florida taxpayers, you know, an additional $51 million a year over just incarcerating those gentlemen for life without parole, almost $1 million a week. Is that right?
That's the best estimate that's been made so far, and that is unchallenged by the Attorney General's office or anyone else, because they know that number is low, because it really, there hasn't been a cost study done recently. So at a minimum, it's $1 million a week extra, and that's over and above the cost of sentencing those same people to life in prison without parole. At the same time, we accumulate this $50 million a year. There are 14,000 unsolved homicides in Florida and virtually no funding for cold case squads. Law enforcement, in many cases, doing the best job they can, but they just don't have the funding to have real, state-of-the-art cold case squads. So, and services for victims of violent crime and their families have been cut back. Proven effective crime prevention programs have been disbanded in many parts of our state and cut back as well. The goal should be, I think, to prevent these violent crimes and these murders from happening in the first place. And you do that by preventing crime, you do that by helping the victims of violent crime, helping them to heal and their families, and solving more unsolved homicides. All this money and time and energy and attorneys from the state flying to D.C. before the Supreme Court and all that kind of nonsense, it's not necessary. It does nothing to keep us safer. And that all those resources could be used in a much better way. In a way that doesn't put blood on all our hands.
That's a really good point. But another one too, it's kind of connected to that. You know, is it the courts and the officers of the courts are also human beings, and they make mistakes. And this punishment is you can't undo it. You know, once you've executed somebody, you know, you can't undo it. I mean, do you by any chance know how many people have been executed who have later been found not guilty?
Well, that's always difficult to prove, because the resources, you know, for attorneys, there's no court to go to prove that someone's innocent after they've been executed. In Florida and in other states, evidence is automatically destroyed. It's, 6 months or so after an execution.
Sure.
So it's hard to go back and prove that. Now, what we do know here, more than any other state, is we've made more mistakes of sending innocent people to death row in the first place. We've had 25 people sent to death row that were later released due to evidence of wrongful conviction and innocence. And to go to the point you made, Juan Melendez, who was on death row in Florida for almost 18 years before evidence was brought to light that had been concealed at the time of his trial. It was actually a confession of the actual killer. And he was released. But Juan likes to say, you can free an innocent person from jail, but you can never, never free an innocent person from the grave.
That's absolutely right. You know, and You know, and that's kind of the whole point of it, is that, I mean, I know there are, you know, some people out there, you know, who don't necessarily believe that our laws should be structured so that, you know, no innocent man is falsely accused, and in that way, you know, occasionally some guilty people get through. I mean, I've talked to people that feel like it should be the other way around, that, you know, the legal system should be structured in a way to ensure that absolutely no guilty people ever get away, and if occasionally you catch an innocent person in the net, then so be it. But that, to me, sounds crazy.
Yeah, a good question we can all ask ourselves is, how many innocent people on death row, how many innocent people executed is too many? You know, for me, one innocent person shows that there's a problem. When we have the national record of 25, it shows that there's a real problem in Florida with wrongful convictions and death sentences. And how it works in Florida, why, you know, there's a host of reasons why this happens and how. Primarily, 95% or more of the people on death row have something in common, and that's they could not afford a lawyer at the time of their arrest. People with really good attorneys typically do not go to death row. That's one of the things in common. The other is that their victims were white people. Never in the history of Florida, going back to territorial days, almost 200 years where records have been kept, has a white person been executed for killing a black person. So that's another contributing factor.
That's amazing. I didn't know that. That's amazing.
There's a lot that people don't know. There's a saying, the more you know about the death penalty, the less you like it. And I have found it true, and it's been true for others, too. So if folks will just take the time to, say, visit our website to find out information on the death penalty in Florida, that's fadp.org.
Sure.
To find out information on the National Death Penalty, the Death Penalty Information Center has wonderful information. They're the clearinghouse for all its information nationally. It's deathpenaltyinfo.org. And internationally, Amnesty International keeps the best records of the death penalty worldwide.
You know, speaking of, you know, your organization, it is, in fact, a coalition of, you know, many groups. You know, could you like, name a few? I know like, Pax Christi, the Catholic group, is involved. And about how many Floridians are involved you know, Floridians for an alternative to the death penalty?
That's a good question. Because we are a true coalition of groups and individuals, we have direct subscribers. We have a couple thousand, but some of these groups that are part of the coalition have tens of thousands of members. You know, every group is a little different. So I've never done a count of how many. It's estimated that something like 5 million voting-age Floridians support ending the death penalty. And if we can just connect more people to use their voice and stand up and speak out, contact Governor Scott. You can call his office directly and just say, you know, I do not approve of these executions. You know, and that's the kind of information and input they need. They need to hear it from the public, that this is not something we approve of. These killings are done in the name of the people of the state of Florida, and we simply, they're unnecessary, or whatever reason you want to give, they just don't need to be done.
You know, do you have any allies in government here in the state? I mean, is there anybody in the legislature that is, you know, supports your group and wants to or has tried to introduce legislation that would you know, ban the death penalty in Florida or abolish it?
Certainly, and that's growing every year. Representative Michelle Raywinkle Vasalinda out of Tallahassee 4 years ago introduced a bill to end the use of the death penalty. And every year the support for that in committees and among other legislators has grown, because what that did, that opened the door to discussing the death penalty and to for legislators to find out more about it. So there is a bill this year in the House to end the use of the death penalty. And it's with a bill, then legislators will sometimes, hear this issue out, and many of them reach a new stance on it, a new conclusion. That, you know, it's a government program that wastes money, it makes mistakes, and it's just not necessary.
Yeah, you know, it's you know, what do you think it's going to take to change the law? I mean, do you think perhaps you know, referendum might be a way to go?
Referendums take a huge amount of funding and resources and time and energy. And in Florida, you know, you need 60% of voters
right.
to approve that. It's a tough road to take. And when there's such a need for resources to, you know, for people to just contact their representative or their state senator
yeah.
and tell them, you know, as constituents, we do not approve of these executions if they're not needed. If, you know, if it's a choice, then please do not do them in our name. Let's use that money to protect the public or whatever. There's so many good reasons. And the information that we put out is all cited and resourced, and people can see where it came from.
Sure.
It's not opinions, but it's information.
Yeah.
The goal is for people to make informed decisions and not the old knee-jerk reaction about killing people who killed, and finding out more. And that will, in many cases, lead to, you know, a new way of seeing this issue. It is important. It's expensive, and it puts blood on all our hands. These killings are done in our name. We can't turn away from them and think that, you know, they're just going along okay, or that, you know, these officials know what they're doing.
You know, playing devil's advocate, you know, perhaps a little bit, one last question. You know, why do seemingly civilized people still think it's okay, you know, for the state to murder people? I mean, you must hear the other side. What's people who are in favor of the death penalty say? Why is that still necessary? Is it just a revenge thing?
Well, typically it's revenge. Probably the most common reason is, you know, an eye for an eye. And that goes back to the Hebrew Chronicles, some people call it the Old Testament, you know, but... And of course, the gospel of Jesus is totally turns that on its head, and he addresses it directly. And the way that the death penalty is carried out, where it targets the poor, the innocent people are you know, sent to death row, sometimes executed, that doesn't jive with any faith community that I know of. The way it's practiced, you know, left up to political leaders and those that do it strictly out of, you know, it's expeditious, it's convenient. And so there's basically a knee-jerk reaction among people to support it. And they simply just don't understand, because it's not a pleasant issue to understand. And we just hope that, you know, our government officials are doing it right. But there's so much of this that we just don't know.
Yeah,
the public is just not aware.
You know, that's absolutely right, Mark. And unfortunately, we're like running out of time. But I want to give you an opportunity. And by the way, we're speaking to Mark Elliott from Floridians for an Alternative to a Death Penalty on WSLR 96.5 FM. Please, just one more time, give folks the way they can, you know, get to your website and learn more about this very important issue.
Yes, thank you. FADP, F as in Frank, A as in Apple, D as in David, P as in Paul, .org. We have information there. There are vigils and protests at the time of execution. There's more than two dozen from Pensacola to Key West. There's a vigil protest in Bradenton at the time of execution. There's one in Sarasota. You can go to our website and click on vigils and protests and find a place near you. If you want to stand up and stand out and speak up and speak out. And there's also how to contact the governor's office, which is so key. And please, your elected representatives will listen to you if you call. They need to hear from you if you do not approve of this.
Great.
You think there's a better way?
Great, Mark. I want to thank you again for coming on, and thank you very much for your important work, and you have a great day.
Thank you, Lou.
Right. Bye now.
All right, I know a lot of people have strong opinions about the death penalty. Many of us don't agree with it. And we want to thank Mark Elliott, Floridians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, from coming on.
You know, and Steve, you know, my whole take on the death penalty, I mean, if I really wanted to, you know, have revenge on someone, I think, you know, tucking him away in prison for the rest of his life would be worse than an execution.
All right, let me just get to a couple of events which are coming up. Tonight, we have Melissa Greener. That's Friday, January 30th, tonight at 8 o'clock, right here at the Fogartyville Center here, 10 in advance and 12 at the door. Captivate with quirky crafted lyrics, dynamic melodies, and loads of groove. And then tomorrow night, the Banditos, again at Fogartyville, Saturday the 31st, that's tomorrow night at 8, running the gamut of torch song style balladry to raucous four on the floor rock. The band is a versatile jukebox of rough around the edges musical styles. That's 8 in advance, 10 at the door. You've been listening to Surreal News, your weapon of mass instruction on WSLR. And the news and views you hear are just those people that gave them, the hosts, our guests, not the employees or board members, just the people that gave them. Take what you like and leave the rest. We've got Complex Wave Room with Mark Zimpella coming right up. We're also live streaming at WSLR.org, and we're podcast at thesurrealnews.com if you missed any or part of this. And now we've got Complex Waveforms with Mark Zimpella coming up right now. You've been listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, your true community radio station, and News and Public Affairs. Surreal News, your weapon of mass instruction. And now here's the most excellent Mark Zimpella with Complex Waveforms. Some of great music coming up. Don't touch that dial.